Sea Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 343, Tuesday, August 13th, 2019.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey, Sea Realm Vault subscribers. It has been a while. I do apologize. I am not going to say a whole lot before or after the recording you're about to hear. I'm going to do a solo podcast right after this, but I want to get this one up and out to you lickety-split. So here's a conversation that I recorded with Kevin Lynn of Progressives for Immigration Reform. That is the organization that pays me to draw the, well, write and draw the Geb comic strip. And this was recorded at their office in Lancaster, Pennsylvania over the weekend. The topic is pretty much self-explanatory, but, I mean, if you really wanted to do some homework before listening to this podcast, and I can't imagine why you would, the conversation references John Michael Greer's most recent blog post on Ecosophia. And I will be doing a conversation, a video conversation with high production value down in Lancaster the week after next with John Michael Greer. It's going to be a video, and PFIR, Progressives for Immigration Reform, is going to be promoting that video, even though it's going to be branded Sea Realm, so... good things on the horizon. All right. I said I was going to talk in a later podcast, so here's my conversation with Kevin Lynn. Hey, Sea Realm Vault subscribers. KMO here. And I'm with Kevin Lynn of Progressives for Immigration Reform. And I've been staying down here in Lancaster, Pennsylvania for about the past week. We have been hashing out the next 3 months' worth of Geb comic strips.
And it's going to be a doozy, KMO. I'm excited about it. Good to be here.
And much of the inspiration for the story arc over the next 12 pages came from John Michael Greer's most recent Ecosophia blog post. Kevin, would you do the heavy lifting and summarize what, from your perspective, are the important points in that post?
Well, John's titles something of effect of twilight, another twilight for environmentalism. And what I loved about the article is he kind of talked about the waves of environmental topics, things that seem to capture the imagination of the public and also were eventually backed by government programs. For instance, early on in the environmental movement, there was an understanding that things like population and everything mattered. And then that all went away in the 80s when Reagan came into office. You might recall in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, everyone from the Sierra Club, Nixon, when he was in office, said, well, I think a good sustainable number would be around 200 million, which was about where it was at that time in the early 70s. We're now at 330 million. And I think what happened was, I don't know what happened, but it became pretty obvious that those catering to consumer interests probably won the game. You look at, let's say, the consumer packaged good industry, the Nestles of the world. They don't make more money selling to fewer people. So I think that might have had something to do with it. And again, the whole Reagan where, what I loved about John's article, he talked about how we went from give a hoot, don't pollute, to geckos, greed is good. So things definitely changed. We became much more consumer-oriented. And all of a sudden, the solutions all seemed to, instead of us finding ways to restrain our tendencies, simply became how to best indulge those tendencies.
Part of the blog post describes this event on an island near Sicily where the very, very wealthy and yes. The celebrities went to talk about how urgently we have to address the environment. I just want to read a paragraph from John Michael Greer.
This is hysterical because it just shows the hypocrisy of the environmental movement today.
JMG writes, a little while ago, as some of my readers may be aware, one of the big tech companies sponsored an environmental conference on the island of Sicily. There were 300 attendees, all of them from the oxygen-deprived summits of today's economic and cultural elite. Getting them to and from the event required no fewer than 119 private jetliners, as well as an assortment of fuel-guzzling luxury motor yachts, of course. Of course, the planes and yachts also brought an army of personal assistants, domestics, and all their other human bubble wrap that's needed to keep these fragile pieces of merchandise we call celebrities safe from any untoward contact with the sharp edges of the real world. Among the many other amenities at the conference, the attendees had a fleet of Maseratis waiting night and day on the off chance that one of them might want to take a drive or go look for some scenery. That is to say, counting up all its direct and indirect energy costs, this one conference had a carbon footprint rivaling the annual output of some third world countries. And you guessed it, the point of the conference was to talk about the menace of anthropogenic climate change.
Amazing. Well, I'm curious. What's the pecking order for private jets? I knew the Gulfstream was on top, and then I think Bombardier and then Lear. So we probably shouldn't be too harsh on the attendees. I mean, some of them might have gotten there in a Lear jet as opposed to a Gulfstream.
Given the number of attendees and the number of jets, it came to 3 passengers per private jet.
Can you say carbon footprint?
No.
It's amazing. And there were... wow. That's... it's, again, the hypocrisy, the understanding that somehow we're going to arrive at a better place by not sacrificing.
Well, they're all for sacrifice, just not for them.
Right. And again, going back to John's blog, where he, again, was talking about how, you know, yes, back, you know, when he talked about the book Limits to Growth, and I'm a big fan of the book Limits to Growth, but it was the implementation that John rightly had an issue with, because the implementation was not individual responsibility. It was not about all of us getting together as a republic or, you know, citizens of a republic or a democracy and taking personal action. It was all going to be very top down. There would be a United Nations of sorts governing body then that would be directing us on what to do and how to do it. The means probably didn't justify the ends, and rightly so.
I'm not sure if John Michael Greer talked about this or if this was something I read around the same time, but there have been a good many shipments from a factory in Texas that makes these underground luxury bunkers. People are buying them in Texas and shipping them to New Zealand and burying them under their palatial estates in New Zealand. So the tech CEOs and, you know, the top earners in Silicon Valley are actively and frantically making preparations to bug out.
But the thing is, when I chose to come to the city that we're in now, Lancaster, I chose it for several reasons. One, I'm a Pennsylvanian. Mm-hmm. I do have family within an hour and a half of here, so I have those relations. I wanted a place where I knew that there were, you know, this is one of the, Lancaster County is the, has the largest non-irrigated patch of farmland in the country. So there's food here. There's water through the Susquehanna and Conestoga rivers, albeit them polluted. It's still water. And there's, as you saw when you came in on the train, great public transportation in terms of being able to get to the major cities and everything by rail. Now, you got to think, if you were to bug out to another country, where would you be in terms of how that government and those locals are going to service your needs? There was an incident not too long ago in Mexico where there was kind of a community of American expats, and they had put all their money in a bank. About $40 million went into the bank. And one of the bank employees absconded with it. And the response from the Mexican government was, well, that's between you and the abscombers, and I'm sure, you know, try to get 10 cents on the dollar. And the bank was like, well, we're not responsible. You're going to have to take that guy to court. And they probably would, but they'll probably get back 10 cents on the dollar. again, because you're not a citizen of that country. You don't have the protections afforded a citizen of that country. So I don't know how realistic their expectations are of how they're going to be treated down the road.
Well, New Zealand has just changed their laws to make it harder for non-citizens to buy big pieces of property in New Zealand. Hmm. But Elon Musk just got his New Zealand citizenship, and he stayed a grand total of 12 hours in the country to get it.
So is he like a triple citizen of the world now?
Well, he's from South Africa.
Right.
So I think he has U.S. citizenship.
So he would have had to give up his South African passport to get a U.S. passport. Okay.
You can't have dual citizenship between South Africa and the U.S.?
Unlike, and, you know, I'm an example of this. My mother was born in Ireland, mm-hmm. and I took him up on the bet in the 90s, and I do have an Irish passport. But the stipulation is my mother became a U.S. citizen. She had to renounce prior citizenship. Whereas for me, I was already a U.S. citizen. Now, the U.S. doesn't officially recognize it, but Ireland does. So they sent me the passport. That's how that worked. So I'm wondering if he had to give up his U.S. citizenship to get a New Zealand.
You know, he's rich enough that I imagine the rules just don't really apply.
Hey, you know, they just knocked off Epstein. Yeah, the rules don't apply.
Did you watch the Paul Joseph Watson video on that?
I did. I watched actually several videos. And I was watching that Lino guy live, who is, I usually find rather irritating, but I thought he was spot on.
I don't know who that is.
He's out of New York City. He's got a kind of a squeaky voice, former attorney, mm-hmm. and he blogs about, you know, topical events and politics and things. And he was saying, okay, look, you know, during the week, a newsroom, seeing they're staffed, all the people are there. On the weekend, it's the B team. So Epstein conveniently dies on a Saturday morning. I mean,
and the surveillance cameras in his cell conveniently crapped out at just that moment.
Oh my gosh, what a coinkydink.
And the only thing I'm hearing from NPR and the mainstream media is that conspiracy theories about his death are circulating on the internet.
You know, it's interesting you say that. I was at the gym today. I don't have cable television at home. But the screens are up. There's like four screens up in the gym. And you can see what's going on. And the only time I saw like Epstein's face flashing up was on the local, like the local ABC 10 station. Not on CNN. CNN was covering other things. Oh, they were covering Kamala Harris speaking in front of a bunch of people in Des Moines on gun, you know, not Des Moines, but in Iowa somewhere on gun control. That's what they were focused on, not Epstein, which is, to me, bizarre. I mean, this is a guy that could have taken down, and yeah, I am a conspiracy theorist, the deep state. I mean, when you have the possibility of Prince Andrew, the Clinton, you know, Bill Clinton, all of these very politically connected, powerful people, and God only knows who else, you know, caught up in some kind of, in Washington, D.C., they call it brownstoning event, where you wake up with either a dead hooker or a live boy. You know, it's amazing. And here this guy should have been literally, there should have been two guards right in front of him.
Yep.
It should have been Silence of the Lamb, where they had him in a cage and he's in a straitjacket.
Yes, with the mask on. Yep. And I guess he hung himself. But, you know, even if you're not on suicide watch, if you're just like in the drunk tank, they take your shoelaces.
Right.
I mean, they take common sense precautions against, you know, prisoners committing suicide. And this guy, you know, who was in a position to basically roll over and provide dirt on a whole host of powerful people, just happens to have the means to commit suicide in his cell, and it just so happens that the security cameras went on the fritz at just that moment, and anybody who says that that's in the least bit suspicious is a nutty, you know, living in the mm-hmm. mom's basement with a tinfoil hat conspiracy theorist.
Yeah, and
that's the narrative that the mainstream media is pushing on this. It's beyond the pale.
Yeah, right? And what bugs me is, okay, they shot one of our presidents down like a dog in the streets. And we have to buy the theory that it was one guy who wasn't that great a shot who did it, despite the fact that, you know, there were definitely more shooters involved. There's just so much evidence to indicate something different. Bobby Kennedy, Saran, the last thing he remembered was having breakfast at a restaurant I frequented when I lived in Altadena, California, called the Dutch Oven, I believe was the name of it. And he's having dinner with a woman in a black dress with polka dots and a guy with closely cropped blonde hair. And the next thing he remembers is them kicking a gun out of his hand in a hotel. MK Ultra, all these things, powerful people conspire. And I mean, when you think about it, I mean, you have trillions at stake. I mean, trillions of dollars, the way these guys roll and play, you know? Who is someone to be president of the United States to get in the way of that?
Exactly. President is disposable. He's there for 8 years at the most.
Right. You know? And I think this is, you know, Trump simply wasn't part of that crowd. Like him or love him, he wasn't part of that crowd. I'm sure he's being brought to heel. I'm sure the deals have been cut between, you know, him and the usual players. I think that will always happen. But still, he is not the kind of guy that will, you know, they'll ever fully trust. He seems to say, at least with Trump, I think, unlike Obama, who did pretty much what he was told. I mean, when he was giving a speech, it was on a teleprompter and it was boring. Bush, you knew Cheney was pulling the strings. He wasn't doing, he wasn't adding anything to that. And at least with Trump, you kind of get an inkling of what's going on, you know, behind behind the teleprompter, you know, away from the teleprompter. So I think that's kind of the cool thing about it. But it's a bizarre time right now. But we digress.
We do digress, and I want to digress just a little bit further in that there was something else, I think, from this John Michael Greer piece that it made an impact on me, and it made me change my mind about something, because over the past couple of years, I've grown very impatient with the doomsaying and, you know, just the nihilism that I'm getting from a lot of people, particularly on the environmental left, but also I saw a lot of it in the peak oil scene. That,
and when you say the environmental left, are you thinking like, you know, AOCs, we're all going to be dead in 12 years?
Exactly.
Okay.
There's a certain mentality that if doomsday isn't around the corner tomorrow, if right. we're not talking about cannibalism, you know, and tumbleweeds blowing down the street next year, I don't care. And so, you know, people gravitate to these really hyperbolic, apocalyptic scenarios. And, you know, some of the people that I'm friends with, long-time friends with, fall into this camp. And I got impatient with it. And I did a series of videos called Peak Oil Bullshit, like parts 1 through 5.
I saw one of those. I was like, holy shit.
So something John Michael Greer wrote that gave me pause, and I had to nod my head and say, yeah, he's right about that, is that when peak oil was a thing, you would go to a conference and you talk to people, and the people at the peak oil conference, not only are they talking about, you know, these dire consequences that are just, you know, not so far down the pike, but the peak oil folks, for the most part, were willing to make sacrifices and changes in their own lives, their own behavior, their own consumption patterns. They were willing to do things differently in order to get a better outcome. Whereas with the environmental folks, particularly, you know, at the celebrity level, they are not willing to compromise their lifestyles in the slightest.
No, not at all. In fact, they're, you know, it's not about giving up something. It's about, we were talking earlier, like I drive a 2004 Subaru, and last year I put about $4,000 into it, along with another $1,000 to get that iPhone thing that connects to my iPhone, so I have that. And I'll get another 100,000 miles out of it. I mean, we changed out a bunch of things in that car, and I'll get another 100,000 miles out of that 2004 Subaru. And What if I'd have gone, what would have been, so there's that carbon footprint. But compare that to a, contrast that to a carbon footprint, like if I were to buy a Prius. You know, the lithium's got to get mined somewhere. we need to be, as you were saying, we need to be looking at how we can get by with less. I mean, and frankly, where I live, I might need to use a car twice a week. I can walk here to the studio, and when I need to go to the office in DC, I take the train. I've tried to arrange my life so that I'm less dependent on fossil fuel.
But you don't have a Maserati on standby to take you to your Learjet?
No, and that's always bothered me. You know, I got... Where am I in the pecking order of other men without a Maserati or a private jet?
And, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, but you don't have to count your pennies.
No, I don't. And because I got myself out of debt, I make sure not to go into debt. Those are the things. It's just managing our lives and trying to say no. The problem with that, though, is I have friends who have kids, mm-hmm. and kids are freaking expensive. A friend of mine was like, "Wow, dude, it's going to be $15,000 for the braces for the two of them." Ugh. And you think, "Holy shit!" I mean, it's really hard to program for that, particularly today where people are earning less. Wages have stagnated for the productive class in this country, and costs are going up, particularly medical. And you look at what it costs to hold a family together anymore. The way poor people do it, who are immigrants, illegal immigrants, like in California, for instance, the way that's done is you live 2 to 3 families a household. I was laughing at a congresswoman there who was talking about how, you know, they have all this great housing and it's like, no, your people are making it in the San Gabriel Valley because they're doubling up. And, and it's interesting, I don't know a lot of single guys who are living alone. Most have roommates anymore. And that used to not be the case. It certainly wasn't the case in the 80s, you know.
I live alone, but I have a really sweet deal in terms of rent.
Yeah, you do.
Location. So.
Well, you got a cat.
I do have a cat. Cat does not contribute to expenses at all. I keep talking to her about a part-time job, and she's just not having it.
Cats are funny that way.
So we're working around to the main point, I think, of the John Michael Greer article, and this is the point of departure for our comic strip arc. Is that how to phrase it without going down too many rabbit holes or segues? We're going to introduce a character who's based on Charlie Hall.
Yes.
Although he's very much a background figure.
I like what you did with the name. We won't be spoilers here, yeah. But I think I know your audience is probably going to really dig it.
So Charlie Hall, for the maybe 2 people listening to this who don't know, is a professor of biophysical economics. And he was a kind of a celebrity in the peak oil scene.
I think he's living by my sister now in Montana, but up
he did
in,
move to
in
Montana,
the Flathead Valley. Right? Yeah.
But, you know, his whole academic orientation is, you know, let's look at energy budgets, let's look at materials, and let's do the math and see what's physically possible and, you know, structure our society to operate within the limits of, you know, what's available to us. And the shorthand for that is ecological limits.
Yeah.
You know, this planet can only provide so much support. And what John Michael Greer said in the blog post is that there's a fringe, an environmental fringe, you know, on the left in the blogosphere right now, which has been making the case that to take the notion of environmental limits seriously is just straight up racism. It's just the only reason you would do that is because you hate brown people.
Right.
And that's a nutty notion, but John Michael Greer predicts that that is about to move from the lunatic blogosphere fringe into mainstream punditry. And it's first going to show up in places like The Guardian.
And it has. Guardian, Intercept. We saw that last week with New York Times. Your audience probably knows I am a restrictionist when it comes to immigration. And I am not about, I mean, I'm the son of an immigrant, but to me it's about the numbers. And when you're looking at the numbers, you have to look at south of the border. And people are coming here for economic advantage. And that's not good for two reasons. It's not good from a labor standpoint because it's all about supply and demand. We did an amazing interview with a building inspector in Los Angeles. He talks about how wages have just dropped into the toilet for construction, which used to be good middle class livings. But from an environmental standpoint, it's about what these numbers do. Again, it's the over the aggregate. For instance, in California, they probably have one of the per capita lowest energy consumption profiles in the country, partly because of the climate, also because they did some things, smart things, a while back, you know, to make houses more energy efficient, refrigerators, and all that stuff. But the aggregate amount keeps going up of their consumption, and they're not adding to the infrastructure to handle that. So these are, and then it, of course, creates sprawl because you got to put everyone somewhere. Here in Lancaster, we were just defeated for months, actually for 2 years. We've been fighting a large development. They want to develop 74 acres of farmland. The owner wants to do it and put in 551 homes. There is no, without, and when I keep going, what is the justification for more homes? Well, you know, we resettle a lot of refugees here and everything, and this is insane. We're going to need that farmland. Here in Lancaster County, as I mentioned earlier, this is the largest patch of non-irrigated, the most productive non-irrigated farmland in the country. And all we want to do is put it on, put houses on top of it. It's insane.
You sent me a link to a column by Joe, what's his last name?
Joe Gazzardi.
Joe Gazzardi. Say a little bit about who Joe Gazzardi is and what his specialty is.
Joe has been writing, he used to teach in the Sacramento School District. He did high school in Puerto Rico. And he saw there the numbers and what it was doing and how they really couldn't service that large a population coming in. So he got very active with a group called California Population Stabilization. Joe also writes about sports, he loves baseball. But he started writing about population issues, and he started working directly with Progressive Immigration Reform 2 years ago. So he does a lot of our columns on topics of immigration, whether it's environment or labor-related issues.
So Joe was responding in the column that you sent me to a talking point on the left right now. This will be kind of a long question, so I apologize in advance. But, you know, there's the whole immigration issue. On the left, you're getting voices who are definitely saying, we just need open borders. It can't be any sort of, you know, violation of the law to cross the border. There can't be any limitations on the number of people who come in. When you push back against that, you'll hear this, and I've heard it repeatedly and seen it in print. Oh, nobody's arguing for open borders. The fuck they're not. Of course they are.
They just said we want open borders. And so, what amazes me, because to me it's about jurisdiction. Like one of me and my employees, that's a jurisdiction. But then we operate in a city, that's a jurisdiction. And that city's in a county, that's a jurisdiction. And a state, and a federal government, and there's international law. When you take away the border, you destroy the jurisdiction. How do you as citizens create laws if you can't control your borders? You destroy that jurisdiction that you're operating in. That's the amazing thing to me. And yet you're right. They're all saying it because they understand it themselves. I lived in Los Angeles for 20 years, and I'm going back again for a couple weeks in September. And they're having, where I used to live in the downtown core before it really gentrified, they're now having typhus outbreaks. I mean, literally, the only reason they're taking action on it is because City Hall is there too. And some senior people in City Hall have been hit with typhus. And these are diseases that are due largely to lack of sanitation. And that's what's going on there. They have no, and because you have Skid Row down there, that occupies a big area of downtown Los Angeles. And I always tell people, it's a long way to Skid Row. And it usually stops, and it begins with not having an opportunity, which leads to no job, which leads to the downward spiral of drugs and, you know, giving up. You know, there's people down there that are, of course, mentally disturbed, emotionally disturbed, but there are people, and, you know, people who've been in the prison system, and there are people that have simply given up at this point. One activist told me, a black activist, he said, this is the fastest growing zip code for African-Americans in the country.
I was in the car for that conversation.
That's right, yeah. And that's the amazing thing is, again, we bring in all the new immigrants coming in are eager to work, but they're displacing the people there. Because if you're an employer, and I did a blog on this 2 years ago, I was sitting in my favorite restaurant in downtown Los Angeles, and the owner comes up to me. And usually she goes, well, what are you reading, Kev? But this time she goes, can I sit down with you? And she sits down in front of me and she goes, you need to understand, I can't do this without my illegals. I can't get a native born to stand over that stove for 8 hours a day. One of them's sick. Next day there's someone in their stead. I don't have to do anything. We had a woman managing this place. She took us to the labor board. You don't understand. And I said, well, so when they're sick, do you pay health care? No. Do you give vacation? Do you pay vacation? No. Should someone be standing over a stove 8 hours a day, maybe 6 hours a day, maybe four, maybe shifts, maybe if pay reflected that? And why did they take you to the labor board, by the way? You know, but, you know, employers want an easily exploitable workforce. And the problem is, it's not a level playing field. If you play by the rules, you won't be competitive. And that's pretty much what she was telling me. And that's the problem with this surge from so many numbers from the South, because they will push out the higher earners, people that might say, you know, I'm not going to put up with this kind of work. And they'll find someone that's very eager to do it. This is nothing new. This is the way it was from the late 1800s to 1924 in this country.
Yeah, what's been an aberration has been the post-World War II economic boom, which for 30 years was pretty widely shared. You know, wages grew at about the same pace as the general economy.
Yes.
And then for the last 30 years, the economy has doubled again, but wages have remained stagnant. But the point that I wanted to get around to with Joe Guzzardi is that he addressed an objection that I've been hearing from people on the left, which is the United States has lots of empty space in it. You know, so we have space for lots of people. Now, I like to drive cross country, particularly when I have a nice car. And so I have driven through Wyoming, Montana, Eastern Oregon, Idaho.
Yeah, Four Corners region. Yeah.
These states are empty of people. But the reason for that is there's no water.
Yeah, there's no water there. There's no arable land. You wouldn't want to live there, really. I mean, there was that priest years ago came with this thing. Well, you know, if you took the whole population of the world, you could fit it into Texas.
I'm like, yeah, with elbow room. You're touching the next person without even extending your arms. But people have to eat. You know, people have to drink. People need jobs. People need services. People need infrastructure. And none of that exists in these wide open spaces in the Western United States. They're empty for a reason. It's not that we haven't filled them yet. We're not going to fill them until, you know, we no longer need fresh water.
Yeah, and the reality is, too, all this growth in population that we've experienced is very dependent on infrastructure that's falling down. We haven't made big infrastructural investments since the 1930s. I mentioned Altadena, California. Their sewer systems operated 118% of capacity. It's not unusual to find places where their sewer systems, their water treatment systems, all their infrastructure is operating at 100% or more capacity. And we need to make significant investments in that. And that's something we haven't been doing. And all we keep doing is adding to the burden of these systems, which means ultimately, John Michael Greer exposed me to this term a few years ago called catabolic failure.
Catabolic collapse.
Mm-hmm. And that's what you see. You see that in Los Angeles. Just Saturday morning, I posted a video, a Joe Rogan video, where he's leaving California. He's had enough.
Yeah.
And that everyone I talk to in California, I go back, I'll give you a great story. So I'm at a house in Beverly Hills, and I'm talking with the owner, and she goes, "Oh, progressives for immigration reform. That's really Orwellian, Kevin." I'm like, "In what respect?" "Well, how can you as a progressive be for restricting immigration and all that?" And I said, "Well, you know, you grew up here in California, born here, grew up here. We were just talking about you putting in new bookshelves here, but then you're talking about moving to Asheville, North Carolina." And I'm like, "Why?" "Well, you've seen the traffic here. You've seen, I mean, it's so, the quality of life is so degraded in Los Angeles for the productive class. Everyone just wants out. The costs are so high to just enjoy a decent quality of life." And as I had mentioned when I posted that, I said, "You know, the little things are, you know, everything is a sacrifice. You know, the commute to work is a sacrifice because it's long and drawn out. Going to the beach is a sacrifice because that you got to do within a certain time slot or you're just going to be stuck in traffic. Running errands. But the big things are that if you have kids, for instance, there are only two decent high school schools in all of LA Unified.
In the public schools.
Right. La Cañada, Calabasas. And to be in those, you eat it in the mortgage.
Right.
Outside of that, you're paying about 15 to 20 grand a year to have your kid in private school because you don't want them in LA Unified. I mean, these are the costs of trying to get by in a place like that and be normal, be average. And that's wearing thin. And I thought that what Joe Rogan said was indicative of what's really going on.
What really struck me about Joe Rogan saying that he's going to move out of L.A. is that he came to this decision after visiting Italy.
Good point, yeah.
Economically, Italy is a total basket case. You know, in terms of their economy, they are really screwed. But their social priorities place quality of life well above where we place it in the United States. In the United States, you know, even rich people in Los Angeles are suffering. You know, their quality of life is diminishing because we elevate making money above living having a life worth living.
Yeah.
And in Italy, you know, they don't have much money, but they understand what makes a good life. And Joe Rogan, just as a visitor, goes there and is struck by the difference, and he realizes, man, I got to get out of L.A. This is garbage.
Yeah, it's like when you're living in it, you don't see it, but once you're out of it, and it's funny because, and when I talk to people who lambast me for this, one woman on Facebook was saying, you know, "I'm sick and tired of you criticizing L.A. and, you know, you bugged out essentially." And I'm like, it's Kubler-Ross. You know, she is in the denial stage. And some people are. Then there's the anger stage. I'm going to try to do something. And then there's the acceptance phase. And it's like, you know, there's just no saving this.
You know, if you're pretty well off and you fly everywhere, you can't force people to do this, but my recommendation is take the train, go anywhere by train, and leave your electronics turned off and just look out the window. You will pass through these pockets of prosperity, these pockets of things, you know, places where stuff's taken care of, the streets are maintained, the buildings look nice. And then you leave those pockets, and this country is falling apart.
Yeah.
It's just a sea of decay. And I so saw that coming, you know, on the train here from Bellows Falls just a few days ago.
I mean, some of these places are like war zones.
Yeah. Now, I have to say, Lancaster, Pennsylvania is a spot of prosperity. Stuff seems to be taken care of here.
Yeah, I don't like to advertise that because people are. I was walking to the market the other day. And there was a family there from upstate. They were from just on the fringe in New York City. And he was like, "Hey, what is it like here? Are they kind of like rednecky here and everything?" And I asked him where he was from. And
where's he from?
Some little burb outside of New York City. I forget the name of it. But there, they were the last house that hasn't sold out to a developer. And they're about to, and now they're looking for a place to go. And I almost hate to say it. No, this you're in a. This is a very the city itself is liberal. The county is you know, it's blue and red, you know.
You got a lot of Amish and Mennonite here.
Yes, we have. It's like, because you talk about like the well taken care of. That's that Germanic thing. You know, your house will be neat and clean. So there is that culture. And having grown up in Pennsylvania, close to Mennonites, we being Roman Catholic, we were the Auschlanders, you know, never the idol worshippers. But it was much easier for me to come back, let's say someone had been in this culture before, because you have to understand these people, folk here can trace their roots some as much as 11 generations.
They have a coherent cultural identity.
Yeah.
That's a crime now.
Yeah, that farm I brought you guys to yesterday, that has been in the same family since 1748. So I tell people when they move here, understand you're coming into a stream that has been flowing a long time. Do what you can to help. And flow with it, and it'll be good. You'll find that this is an amazing place. And, you know, and it's funny, too, here, because, like, in L.A., the second question people would ask you is, so what do you do for a living? Because they're trying to peg you on that socioeconomic scale. Are you worth talking to, spending time with?
Am I going to profit from our relationship?
Exactly. Hey, let's do lunch. How can I get the most out of you with the least amount of effort? Here, the second question is, so what church do you belong to?
Ah.
Because there, it's like, okay, where do you fit in kind of more of a circular relation to me? You know, are you in my church? If you're not, are you in my faith? If you're not my faith, are you, you know? It's a very interesting thing that I found here. Now, me being a pagan puts me out of all that, but, you know, I haven't had any issues.
Now, one thing you get here that we don't get in Bellows Falls, which is not a prosperous, well-taken care of place, is that, you know, there are homeless people in and around Bellows Falls, but there's plenty of woods for them to go camp in. And you're not confronted with homelessness every time you step out your door. Whereas last night I was standing in your kitchen, your very nice kitchen, and I was looking out the window and I saw a woman who appeared to be in her 60s or 70s, basically changing her clothes, just out in the street, but trying to do it in a modest way, you know,
right,
covering a breast as she, you know, took off one shirt and put on another. And once she was changed, she lay down on the bench and went to sleep, clearly homeless. And, you know, in anytime you have an urban core that's walkable, you're going to get people on the streets who really don't have any place to go. And they're just lingering on the streets.
Right. And that also, right across the street, is the county building.
Yeah.
And so services are there. It's also, the police aren't going to move them along if they, there's probably, I'm sure, like everywhere else I've lived, there's an understanding that, you know, after maybe 11 p.m. at night, you can go ahead and crash there. In the winter, you won't see the homeless a lot, but because I think shelters and churches open up. But yeah, we have homeless here, and the number's increasing. We have the same problem with heroin and other drugs here as well. The morgue is full, as in most counties, I think, across the country anymore. But, you know, we were lucky in Lancaster. My landlord had been a state senator here for 24 years. And he told me in the 70s, when they began to do these economic revitalization projects, like the baseball field, the convention center, the usual things. And someone said to him, they said, why don't you just build a wall around the city and let it die? That's how bad it was. And they refused. And the 11 years prior to me moving here, there was a fellow by the name of Gray who was the mayor. And is a new urbanist.
Mm-hmm.
His wife owned an art gallery. His job before being married was he was head of the National Motorcycle Association. Very open-minded. He was liberal, yet very fiscally conservative, too. And he was able to kind of strike that balance, get rid of the really ugly things that needed to get tore down, preserve the things that we have. And the results have been amazing. My place is, it has a walkability score 99. out of 100. So great progress was made in that respect. I know Deneen, the current mayor, has her challenges as she, you know, fights the powers that be. That we, for instance, were able to stop the building of this 14-story monstrosity that was going to take out a warehouse that was built, you know, during the Civil War. And it's a constant fight, and it's something that the nice thing about Lancaster, because of the scale, it's a 55,000, the population of 55,000 here. So it's easier to get your arms around it, and it's easier to have the citizenry a little more active. And because it's like, it'd be like anywhere else, but here we don't have the corruption like we did in Los Angeles. I mean, the deals were always there. Like, we would fight Walmarts and things and always lose. Whereas here, you know, we're, what, 2-4 in terms of stopping developments? So, not too shabby.
Well, let's look for the exit.
Okay.
So we have to stop right now. But returning to the big picture and the points that John Michael Greer was making in his most recent blog post, how do you... In your experience, because you're in, you run a variety of nonprofits, and you regularly go to Washington, D.C., and you interact with the political class, and you call yourself progressive.
Yes.
And you don't think that you're cheating to do that.
No, because, and I tell, you know, I used to be on the executive board of the California Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. I ran, according to Jim Dean, Howard Dean's brother, the most effective Democracy for America chapter west of the Mississippi. I mean, I was there fighting the Iraq War. You know, I carried the water. Now, everyone knew me for this kind of fringe opinion I had on immigration. I just don't think they thought it would go anywhere with me. But what we face is... there's all these templates you have to put over everything before you get to what's going on at the local level. And I think a decision was made a long time ago, back in the 90s, when we saw things like NAFTA, GATT, the WTO, to no longer invest in the West and America, well, Europe and America, and to invest in Asia where all the profits can be made, because that's where they moved our manufacturing. And now we see with all this employment labor abuse, like the H-1B, OPT, CPT, F-1 visas, where they bring in, you know, they basically displace American skilled workers. They used to, you know, initially tech workers, and now it's accountants, bookkeepers, you name it. They're getting displaced. So they're stripping the intellectual property out as well now. And immigration is forefront in this. If we restrict immigration, we make it work for the citizens, it's not going to work for the elites. And that's where the rub is. And the elites have the power. We were successful last year in fighting a bill on that would have really hurt skilled workers in the U.S. It would have ended country caps, and we talked about that before. But it came back again this year in another form of another bill. And it passed the House, and, you know, we'll be really lucky if we can keep it off the floor of the Senate between now and the end of December. And that's where we see the corporate interest playing out. We see, I mean, the Business Roundtable, which is Microsoft, American Airlines, all these guys, they're backing this bill. They want this cheap labor. And there are very few people fighting it. The problem is professionals here in the U.S., the white-collar workers, they don't have that lineage of activism and organizing doesn't exist really. I look at my
they haven't needed it in living memory.
Exactly. Yeah. My great-great-grandfather, my father's side, came here from Lithuania in 1874. He went right to work in the coal mines in Pennsylvania, you know, eventually succumbed to black lung like everyone did. At working in those mines, but he was a hell of an activist. I mean, at that time, you had things like the Hazleton Massacre going on. You know, the Celts and the Germans and the Slavs had united to, you know, fight for better working conditions in the mines. And that was a struggle. And people understood the value of a job and what a job could do. I remember, I'll tell this story, and I'm sorry for going on, but I think it's an important story. When I left the military, I left as a captain and officer.
And just, you mentioned the deep state earlier.
Yes.
And right now, that phrase is being demonized in the mainstream media as tinfoil hat conspiracy theory, but your background in the military was intelligence, right?
Yes, I was a counterintelligence officer. I worked in Asia. I worked in Europe.
So you're not getting your notions of the deep state from Alex Jones.
No, no. In fact, I had had one brush with it when I was there. And, I mean, I had access to, of course, TSSCI clearance.
Which is?
Top secret, especially compartment information. So you had to go through all the background checks and all that. Mm-hmm. But the caveats and the stuff I had access to, those caveats were classified. That's the level of stuff that I was working in. And the kind of people I was associating with. So I understand the deep state for what it is, in that, you know, people who work in government are just kind of tools of it. They see themselves as something different, but really they're working with that deep state. They're, ultimately, there's a principle somewhere driving things. But I got out of the military, and I was full of myself. You know, I'm a manager, I'm this, you know.
And you're a young man, youngish.
Yeah, I was 28 at the time. And I stayed with friends of my father's growing up in Pittsburgh. And the wife was home because she'd broken her leg, so we were having breakfast. And I had said something demeaning about labor. And she read me the riot act. KMO, she looked at me and says, "Look outside. You see those cars? We weren't supposed to have them. This house. We weren't supposed to have this house. None of this. Unions gave us everything. Unions give it to us today." And I mean, she was right. And unfortunately, that spirit, that understanding you have to organize, has been lost. Tech workers were probably the most vulnerable because they tend to want to work alone and do their thing. And you know, as
it makes it very easy to manipulate.
Absolutely. You know, to me, I was shocked when I got into this because I did get into that battle over skilled labor a little bit later. Because PFRD in 2008, when we founded it, we were looking really at our most vulnerable, you know, people on the lower end of the wage scales that were being the most victimized by huge supply swaths of labor coming up. But it's the skilled labor now. That's the productive, the highly productive class that's being displaced. And I
asked. And it's just getting started because right now they're being displaced by cheaper human workers, but the intellectual workers are the easiest, their jobs are the easiest to automate. The person who's slaving over the stove at your friend's restaurant for 6 hours a day, that job is much safer in terms of falling to automation than the radiologist's job.
Could very well be. Yeah, that's another thing that's going on that's fueling a lot of this. But
we can't talk about that, though, because
that's a whole other conversation. We're going to Alice in Wonderland with that one.
Well, we're going to Andrew Yang land with
let me finish real fast.
Yeah.
You know, when they would do these wholesale displacements starting, you know, several years ago up to just 2-3 years ago, like they would walk into an IT department, 200 people, bring them all in a room, say, "We're going to outsource this to a company called, let's say, Tata Consulting Services, and you're going to have to train your replacement." And that replacement was typically from India on an H-1B visa. My thought was, why the fuck didn't every one of you walk out that hour? All right, fine. You want me to train you? Fuck you. You train them, asshole. I'm leaving with what's between my ears.
Yep.
Now, that would have nipped that shit right in the fucking butt. But that's not how people thought. And it's like, well, you know, I'll be able to hold on for 6 more months here, and then I'll get some severance, and I'll find something for sure. And now I have talked to so many tech workers out there, people with great skills that haven't worked since 2013. And it's difficult. In fact, I was talking to one fellow, Neil Johnson, who's really an amazing guy. He's working contract at a place, and he said he doesn't know if he'll continue there. It's a big company as a tech worker. But he said, "Look, I'm going down to the community college next week. I'm going to get my commercial driver's license. I know this guy. He bought a truck for $40,000. He's making over $200,000 a year. You know, moving."
hazardous waste stuff. I mean, that's ultimately, sadly, that's where, you know, a lot of our skilled workers are. It's like they either got to find something in logistics or HVAC. You know?
They have to apply their intelligence and their creativity to figuring out how to create economic relevance for themselves, because the system doesn't do it for them automatically the way it did in the first 30 years after the end of World War II.
And I think that's actually a good point. I was speaking with Leo Pereiro, one of the tech workers at Disney who had gotten displaced. And he really wants to do more work in the area of kind of having tech workers be more proactive in that. You know, like for instance, if you go out and get this one certification, you might be able to command $40,000 a year, you know, just off of that. And then also people like Dina Moore, who are, you know, trying to work on, make people more resilient. You know, myself personally, I've slept on couches when things have gone bust for me. But you learn to get back up. And for a lot of people, they may not have that skill set. And it is a kind of a skill set.
And it's also it's an ingrained set of expectations based on your earlier experience. So you had experiences in your youth. You know, you said you got out of the Army at age 28. You'd had a lot of accomplishments. And you've got this sense of, you know, personal empowerment. A lot of people never had that. So when they get knocked down for the fourth or fifth time, they don't even see the point in trying to get up. And that's why life expectancy in this country is decreasing, because so many people are dying of drug overdoses and committing suicide.
Right. You lose that, you know, to them, opportunity, hope, it's lost.
And they just have nothing in their own personal experience to give them the incentive to get back up and try again, you know, after they've been pushed down again and again and again. And eventually they think, well, this heroin feels pretty good, and I know how to get it, and it's pretty cheap. And, you know, all this struggle just didn't get me anywhere, so fuck it. And some people will turn to heroin, but some people will turn to violence, you know?
Yeah.
And if you have a charismatic demagogue who incites people's anger, there is a potential for violence, which, again, is why, you know, the CEOs in Silicon Valley are all buying doomsteads in Alaska and New Zealand.
Yeah, which we could jump down the fourth turning rabbit hole at this point, couldn't we?
We won't.
We won't. Although I want to, yeah. We won't.
I know the listeners can hear that I'm rushing this. I need to go pick up my kids. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But Kevin, it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Great, Camo. Thanks for having me on the show. And thank you to your listeners. They're awesome.
All right, everybody. That was my conversation with Kevin Lynn. I'm still a little punch drunk from so much travel. You know, I really love to travel. And I haven't been able to do it recently, you know, other than, well, I suppose I have been traveling, but it's been, you know, the stressful kind of travel where it's jump in the truck and drive for 10 hours and then busy, 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 and then jump in the truck and drive for 10 hours. And, you know, the kind of travel I like to do is where I move to a different place and I stay there for a while and get to know a new place slowly and well, which I guess is the result of, or possibly the motivating factor behind, me having lived in so many different places over the course of my life. Is there anything in particular that you would like me to talk about? For those of you who have been following my daily YouTube videos, I am basically talking exclusively to the Yang Gang on YouTube these days. I have found my topic. I am gaining subscribers there, but my YouTube channel is no longer, you know, the video version of the Sea Realm. So if there are any threads from the videos that you would like to see continued, well, they can be continued here in audio format. Just let me know. You know my email address, I bet, but just in case you don't, it's kmo@c-realm. That's realm.com. All right. Thank you very much for your ongoing interest in the topics that I'd like to talk about. You give me hope and inspiration. Thanks, all. I'll talk to you again very soon. Stay well.